Hello. Hold on a second. I've just realized that my camera isn't switched on. Damn. Okay, hold on a second. My apologies, everyone. Okay, welcome to the 13th night of Millennial. Let me just make sure that that is the 13th night. Yes, it is. The 13th night of Millennial 8. And I'm now here with UK Column, the three main guys from UK Column. That is Brian Gerrish, David Scott, and Alex Thompson. So, welcome back to Millennial. I think this is the third time that you've appeared.
It is. 2017, okay. And then last year, 2021.
Right. Okay. Obviously, quite a lot has happened this year. Before we get to that, Brian, would you like to introduce UK Column just to anyone who doesn't know of it, who isn't familiar with it?
Okay, thank you very much for that, and yeah, thank you for having us on tonight. UK Column is a news outlet. It's now web-based. We are live at 1 o'clock UK time on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday. We're also doing other web-based events. We've done a number of sessions, Doctors for COVID Ethics, for example. We are doing quite a lot of interviews with people covering a whole range of topics at the moment. That may be to do with COVID policy, vaccine damage, could be economics, could be foreign relations, could be to do with the Constitution. And we've also got an increasing selection of very good, I have to say, articles coming up on our website covering all those subjects and more. So we're a group of people that have gone from producing an A4 sheet. That was where we started well over 10 years ago, probably nearer 15 years ago now. And when the print costs increased, that forced us to look at how we should get information out. And we decided that the best thing to do was to move to a sort of video broadcast format. The other advantage being is that if you go for print, you're always slightly behind the news, particularly if it's changing quickly. So we're now web-based. You can find us at ukcolumn.org. That's ukcolumn.org. And I'll just say that the other member of the team, Mike Robinson, is already away for some very well-deserved holiday. So he should be with his parents in Northern Ireland. So I'll just give him a mention because nothing would be happening in the UK column without Mike's expertise.
All right. I don't know how it would look if he were to appear as well. Then we would have five people on screen. This is the first one I've done where there are four people on screen. So it's interesting. It looks very, very busy compared to the usual millennials. Okay, so that is a good introduction to UK Column. You were on last year. Then the main thing was COVID and the World Economic Forum and the UN and so on. This year, a different story has really dominated the news, and that is the Ukraine war, Russia's special military operation into the Ukraine. I'd like to get each of you to comment on that. Alex, first, what is your perspective on this whole thing and the ramifications of it? But first, the war itself.
Well, this war was predicted by anyone who had their eyes open, both in the West and in Russia and in Ukraine itself, a country that I visited from top to bottom and west to east over at least 15 years. And it was a country of peripheral relevance to me in my old job in British intelligence, GCHQ. It was in that period that I started visiting it. Certainly in the last decade, it's been obvious that the West wished to use the Ukraine as the last ditch in which to stop and curtail Russia's regaining of its status in its own region of influence, its sphere of influence. It was obvious to anyone who had historical understanding that the Russians were going to die in a ditch over their access to Sevastopol, naval base, if not the whole of the Crimea, because that is their warm water port, their window on the world. It's not just of sentimental value, it really hems them in to be lords of the tundra if they don't control that. And there's been a huge geopolitical ding-dong over that in Europe since the High Victorian era. And then the run-up to it was the last 8 years when a coup was mounted. And I saw and spoke to the dissidents against the current regime. First, Petro Poroshenko, the chocolate magnate, the oligarch, and then latterly the actor, Volodymyr Zelensky. They get very angry if you call him Vladimir, or it's just the Russian version of his name, who is a Russian speaker natively from the east of and the south of the Ukraine. I saw a lot of the dissidents against him, and I recall as recently as autumn 2021, just over a year ago now, that the conservatives, the Christians, a number of the ethno-nationalists, but it's a very varied scene out there, as you well know, you know, from who would call themselves a Ukrainian nationalist. Numbers of them were saying, this man is the worst president we've ever had. He's a joke. He came to office wanting to bridge the gap between the Russian speakers and the Ukrainian speakers and forge a proper nationhood out of us. And he's reneged on all his promises. No sooner had the war begun in February than they, and I think more sobering to me, given the breadth of my connections from Estonia down to the Caucasus, everyone other than an obvious pro-Russian stooge in the whole of that belt of countries between Germany and Russia, the whole, if you like, of the intelligentsia, as if by the flick of a switch said, we all know that Russia is the old aggressor. Russia must be in the wrong in this war. In the early months of the war, they were conceding that the Ukrainians had gone miles over the red line in taunting and flaunting and inviting an invasion. And when the invasion happened, sorry to say, but you know, from Tallinn down to Tbilisi, like crying babies, we never expected this to happen. The Russians are being bad. Come and save us, paternalistic West. And it really is something that goes back a long way in those countries. And the more I reflect on it, because Christmas is, of course, a time for that reflection, the more I think that they are willfully ignoring the Russian case and the case of Russian speakers in the Ukraine to be left to live in dignity and to have a drawing of borders and an autonomy, if that's the solution that they come to, which reflects that. So this war isn't going to stop anytime soon. Brian and David are perhaps better placed than me to assess what they think the Russians are up to next, because they spend more time looking at it than me. I don't claim to be an expert Kremlinologist anymore. My knowledge is out of date, but just the psyche of the Russian people and of a sizable minority in Ukraine is such that they're not just going to concede. There are other commentators in the scene whom I respect. Certainly the two Alexanders at the Duran are a major one. And they were talking in a live stream today about Zelensky's visit to the Congress, the first time he's been out of Ukraine since the war began in nearly a calendar year. And their attitude is, that they were comparing him expressly with South Vietnamese President Diem. Those of longer memories like Brian will remember the guy who was, you know, tub thumping for Uncle Sam right until the moment he was lifted onto a US helicopter. And more recently, comparing him with President Ghani of Afghanistan. And, you know, Uncle Sam had to airlift his way out of there as well. What a fiasco if it ends that way. But, you know, don't say you weren't told. John Mearsheimer is just one of the names in the American foreign policy establishment who predicted accurately in 2014 how this was going to end up. And it's the US, the EU and NATO that have been pushing all of this. And Brian never tires of saying, and he's quite right, that the glue that binds that all together is off the wall, wacky thinking in London. The foreign policy establishment, and more particularly the think tankery. Particularly the military think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and some of the more exotic think tanks that we see rising and falling, they seem to have decided this is the way that Russia is going to be contained. And there's a fatal attraction there. There's hotheads in those Ukraine and countries to the north and south of it, and there's hotheads in Washington, but more particularly in London, that are very keen for this to go, you know, as close to nuclear as they think they can get away with, in order to, you know, prevent a collapse. And that's even before we get onto the financial side. But I've hogged enough of that analysis. So over to either Brian or David, I think, at this point.
David, how about we hear from you? What's your perspective on the Ukraine war?
Back in 4 years ago, I was doing an article about towards a model of the towards a model of the deep state, and it was looking at the interactions between Europe, America, and Russia, and where this might be going. And the article stopped, but where the conversation within the column continued is Europe is being built up as an alternative power base, but the Europeans aren't interested. The Europeans like the good life. The Europeans are doing nicely from the post-Cold War world order. The Europeans are not interested in going to fight on a battlefield or in spending money on arms. So the Europeans will need to be re-educated. What was the way we were discussing that you would do this? Well, you need to frighten them. So you need a credible enemy. And it's got to be close enough to be scary. So you've really only got Russia. So how do you frighten them with Russia? Well, you want a war. But you don't want a complete, all points war. You want a containable war. So where would you have that? Well, the Ukraine. So you would want a containable, limited war in the Ukraine that just might go nuclear. Maybe one or two nuclear weapons, because that will really frighten the Germans and they'll start building up the military again. So that's where the analysis ended for us in 2018. And then this all started to unfold, and we're looking at this. Now, the core, I mean, Alex mentioned it was predictable, and it absolutely was, right? So I was just quickly looking at the NATO official text of the declaration of the 2008 Bucharest NATO summit. Item 23, NATO welcomes Ukraine and Georgia's Euro-Atlantic aspirations for membership in NATO. We agreed today that these countries will become members of NATO. 2008. Now, this was never going to be acceptable to Russia. But the implications of that is not only that Russia loses Sevastopol as its warm water port, the implication is you put the United States Fifth Fleet there instead.
And that very year, not to try to round off what David's saying, I think you've got more to say, but that very year, 2008, Chris Steele, the head of the Russia desk at MI6 at the time, circulated a report which went all the way up to the palace, as these things do, and all the government, which I read as well, being a relevant desk officer, saying that at least one faction in the Kremlin was prepared to go all the way to nuclear weapons usage to stop NATO getting hold of the Ukraine. That was 6 years before the coup that put Ukraine on a slow, long-term collision course with Russia.
So someone has taken a decision that rather than having the Ukraine as a buffer state, and there's a long history of buffer states for very good reasons between major powers, that's what Afghanistan was, between the British Empire and the Russian Empire. But it was going to be pushed, and Western influence was going to be pushed. And there was never any prospect of this being acceptable to the Russians. So it was a goading. It was a, we are going to push them until they go over the brink. And I don't believe that the Western analysts are stupid enough not to have realised that. And so you've then got it playing out. And how it's played out has been really strange. And one thing that struck me was right up to the point where the tanks started rolling, the Russian narrative on this was coherent, cogent, sensible, measured, accurate. And the minute this tank started rolling, then it was just a fight against Nazis, right? So truth, reasonableness, balance, judgment immediately went out the window when the bullet started flying, as it often does. And at that point, it became very difficult. And the column struggled with this as well. It became very difficult to get accurate information so you could actually comment on what was actually happening in the war. So my take on it, Alex and Brian probably have slightly different takes on it. My take on it is there's been essentially four phases to the war. Phase one, the Russians had seen that the Ukrainians didn't fight and didn't particularly show any organisational skills over Crimea, and they thought if they pushed hard enough, it would collapse. So the phase one was a quick push to see if they could make the entire state collapse. That failed.
And just chipping in to reinforce that, the Russians are now deluding themselves at some level that that will happen if there is some kind of parachuting into Kiev, which I don't want to frighten people into thinking is likely, but the Russians seem to have said from the contacts I've spoken to, that if there were to be some kind of coup in Kiev early next year, that Mr. Average in Kiev would say, oh, well, what the heck? Our overlords are Russian now. Wrong thinking. But that was certainly their thinking early in the war.
So you've then got phase two. Phase two was much more successful. It was quite rapid. It was a push in the south. It took a lot of territory. And the Ukrainian response was a desperate defence, which eventually, at the cost of a lot of material and a lot of men, eventually slowed the Russian advance down to a crawl. All the time during this, there's lots of weapons coming in from the west. This eventually makes a difference. You then get a point where the balance is sufficiently tipped that the Ukrainians could go on to the offensive and be successful. Frankly, I have to be clear here, this surprised me. I didn't think the Ukrainian military had that capability, even with the extra help, but that it clearly did. And they made very significant gains, and they forced the Russians to mobilise. They said 300,000 reserves. It's very unlikely that that figure is accurate, but they sent 300,000 reserves. And then when those reserves came in, it changed to a fourth phase where the Russians seemed to have the marginal upper hand. And we're now going into the winter and we don't know what the next phase is going to be. The one other thing I would emphasise through this is the broader picture. Where we started was the reason for this push was to change the overall worldwide global political and military picture. And one of the parts of that is a remilitarization of Europe. That's what my personal view is underpinning this. And one aspect of that has been the application by both Sweden and Finland to join NATO. And this has not quite gone through because I think it's Hungary and Turkey have not yet approved this. But that the word on the street seems to be that that approval will come in the new year. And you will then have the Baltic being a NATO lake, the Russian Baltic fleet, the ability of the Russians to put anything through the Baltic will essentially be exterminated. The ability of NATO to support the Baltic states will be massively increased. The NATO military position will be significantly improved and the Russian one significantly weakened. So that's one example of the scenario of the narrative that I think is underpinning the war actually playing out and being successful in Western NATO military terms. Where it goes from here, I think that nuclear is actually quite likely to be used. I think they will, if we're right about the overall analysis, pushing the Russians to the use of nuke in some regards will achieve the fear in the West, will achieve the remilitarization of the West, and will achieve painting the Russians as the ultimate bad guys for many years to come, which can be exploited politically. And finally, on the point to do with the London Russe or the London Washington axis, the Pentagon Russe axis of military thinking, we've been commenting a lot for several years on this in the UK column, all through the efforts to get a military union through Europe, which ultimately failed with the Brexit vote of blessed memory. This axis views war as a hybrid warfare. Everything is part of warfare. There is no binary peace or war. It's everything's a spectrum, just like men and women, we're now told, are a spectrum. And therefore, everything in your country is part of your war. And every action you do is viewed as an act of war in this strange prism you're viewing things through. So your political system, your educational system, your belief, church, The nature of the population, the age profile of the population, the wealth, everything, every economic aspect. We don't trade. We don't trade with our neighbours so that everybody benefits. No, it's all part of this warfare, hybrid warfare, great game, which is a fundamentally toxic idea. And this toxic idea has completely taken control of Western military thinking without a single, as far as we can tell, word of protest from anyone in a position of authority to say, excuse me, this is insane. And with that, I'll pass over to Brian.
Okay. Brian, hello.
Well, yes, hello. I'm thinking. Where do I want to come in on this? I think I'd like to start by just saying that although it was many years ago, I've got a military background. I was a naval officer. I spent the bulk of my career at sea during the Cold War period, and in that time, my particular role was as an anti-submarine officer. So I was tracking Russian nuclear submarines and particularly the Russian bombers, both here in the northern Atlantic, but also off the eastern seaboard of the US. And so I'm going to say the comments that I make now, although I left in 93, so my experience is a long time ago, it was experience gained during the Cold War. And it was also experience of, amongst other things, the UK operating directly with the Americans, but also NATO forces operating together. And the underlying theme for most of my military career was that the Royal Navy at that time was acknowledged as being one of the leading navies in anti-submarine warfare. And our job was twofold. It was essentially to protect the US carrier groups, which would be coming across the Atlantic to move up into the Norwegian Sea in order to provide a barrier air defense for Russian air forces and missile carrying planes, such as the Backfire, coming down from the northeast. And also we were part of wider surface forces that were going to help protect the American convoys, which were needed in order to bring the supplies and munitions across the Atlantic. And this latter point, I think, is very important because in that period, it was just a cornerstone that everybody realized there could be no war against the Warsaw Pact and against the Russians unless the full might of American production could be brought into Europe. Now, I have watched since the time that I left the Navy, the UK's military forces reduced and reduced and reduced in capacity until we've got the present situation where I'm going to say I respect the people who are still serving in the Royal Navy, but the truth of the matter is that the Royal Navy is really unable to do its main tasks. We've seen reports, for instance, of the Type 45 destroyers, 5 out of 6 alongside, can't go to sea because they've got engine problems or the water's too warm. The Royal Navy is decimated. The Army cannot put more than 20,000 men into combat and certainly can't put them into sustained combat. And the RAF has insufficient planes for a major conflict. So I've watched the destruction of UK military, but alongside it, we've also seen the destruction of NATO forces, not so much the Americans, but certainly military forces in Europe. So we've seen a reduction across the board, not only in numbers of troops, particularly army, but also with armoured vehicles and missile systems. And there's a very good guy who's talking on YouTube at the moment called Brian Beletic, a former US Marine, I believe, but his knowledge is very good. One of the things he talks about is combined arms warfare. If you want to be able to have a successful military campaign, you have to be able to integrate not only troops on the ground, but also the armour, the air defence systems, and also the air cover. We have got to a point where we do not have this full capability, and this has been obvious for a very long time. So against that background, I have been very surprised to see particularly the UK, but also the NATO, driven really via the European Union, banging the drums for war against for war in the Ukraine, when it's very apparent to me that NATO itself is incapable of fighting a war, particularly directly against the Russians. So we've seen the demise, the decline and the demise of NATO forces, of UK forces in particular. The Americans have kept their capability, but we've noticed something else, and that is that the Americans are not only very stretched because they've got forces dispersed around the world, they've also got forces still engaged in war zones such as Syria. They have debated whether America is strong enough to take on both Russia and China. I smile with black humour at the thought of that, but the Americans can think that one through. So we've watched as a Western power has got weaker, but the bellicose nature for war and pumping up the war in Ukraine has increased. And the bit that I'd like to add to the scenario is I think that the final straw for the Russians was the thought that NATO tactical nuclear weapons were going to be brought right up to the Russian Western border. This was unacceptable, quite rightly so. And so the Russians said, we can allow this to go so far, but we are not going to allow nuclear weapons to come up to our borders. And that to me seemed perfectly reasonable. So let's take it forward. We've discussed the revolution in Ukraine. Let's remember that very quickly in that revolutionary period, the British were at work agitating and controlling Ukrainian society. And the best example for me is not only the many projects by the Foreign and Commonwealth and Development Office, but also the fact that the BBC's own charity, BBC Media Action, was put into Ukraine in order to, quote, modernise the Ukrainian media system. So we had BBC's charity deviously working away in the background to create what it called modern media for Ukraine. And the particular flagship channel is called Suspilny. People can obviously check this. We should be aware that BBC Media Action also agitated in Syria. And one of their project managers is on record as saying that in Syria they worked with people who were against the government and against Sadat. We worked with them in order to help regime change. Now that brings us to the key point, because ultimately what are we seeing the US, UK and NATO saying? That they want not a war won in Ukraine, they want regime change in Russia. Why do they want regime change in Russia? I'm going to suggest because if we look at the trilateral position where the world is going to be driven into three power blocks, that's the Americas, South America, the US and Canada. When we come to Europe within the trilateral program includes Western Europe, it includes Eastern Europe, it includes Russia.
And Africa.
And Africa. And then the third part of the world is China and Japan and the what do they call them? The peripheral Asiatic countries. So I find it very interesting that actually when you hear the West talking about regime change, I don't think they're talking about the policy which has been created by NATO or individual nation states. What we're starting to see is who is really controlling the agenda for war, and that is the very powerful international global think tanks, such as the Trilateral Commission and the World Economic Forum. Just very quickly, if we talk a little bit more about the battlefield, the thing about the battlefield in Ukraine, which is stunning, is that Russia has demonstrated that it has missile systems for which America, UK, NATO have no defense. These are the hypersonic precision missiles. And I believe that the US, the UK and NATO grossly underestimated the performance of these missile systems. And they certainly underestimated the accuracy of them and indeed the number of these missile systems which Russia could bring to bear. But the key point is there is no defense to them. And the thought that one Patriot system is now to be moved into Ukraine is going to change the war is complete nonsense. But if you want a key, if you want one key point to emphasize how worried the US is about Russia's missile capability, the thing that you do not hear in relation to Ukraine is where America has put one of its carriers. In every other war before Ukraine, you would hear that America was moving one or more carriers into the, wherever they could, the closest sea area to the combat, because if they could get a carrier in, they could take air superiority, they could enforce no-fly zones, and they could take control of the battle. In Ukraine, not only is there no mention of the US carriers, the US carriers were withdrawn from the Eastern Mediterranean at a very, very early stage. And that is because the American battle groups around their carriers have no defense against the Russians' hypersonic missiles designed to take them out. So David has suggested that he's very worried about the use of nuclear weapons. I'm not so worried about that because Europe has seen firsthand that Russia is capable of destroying a country's infrastructure, not by using nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons, but by using vast numbers of high precision weapons. And I'm just going to end by saying that when I mentioned that part of my role many years ago was the protection of convoys to bring food, fuel, munitions across the Atlantic in order to give us sufficient provisions to fight the Russians in Europe. What has been demonstrated now is that neither the US nor the UK nor any of the NATO European countries has the manufacturing capacity to produce the weapons in sufficient volume to enable Ukraine to win the war. And so I believe if we look at the battlefield at the moment, Russia is about to press the button for a massive increase in its industrial capacity to produce the munitions it needs.
Possibly aided by Chinese manufacturing capacity.
And with, I think, a bit of help from North Korea and Iran. And the West does not have this capacity. America is talking about producing a few 100,000, 152, 155 millimeter artillery shells in order to assist Ukraine. But the reality is, before they can produce the number of shells required, which is into the millions, America has got to build new factories. And the reality is, not only is that a difficult task for America, America no longer has the industrial base and capacity to support the war in Ukraine. So what is happening now is very, very different from anything that I saw planned, because at the time I was involved in the Cold War, the US, UK and Western Europe did have the capacity to produce this ammunition and munitions. Now we don't. And that's been demonstrated because Ukraine is short of ammunition, is short of munitions. They're desperately begging for tanks and artillery. They're not getting it, not because America or the West doesn't want to give those weapons, but because they simply do not have the capacity to supply them. So my prediction is that Russia is going to continue to dominate the war. It's killing Ukrainians on a scale nobody wants to talk about. And it's going to continue to do that because it is able to shell Ukrainian positions roughly at a ratio of 9-1 of shells. So we are not being told the truth about this war. The Ukrainians are suffering horrific losses, and that is actually going to increase. So I'll leave it there. Do I think Russia is going to take control of this battlefield? Absolutely. And one of the key reasons is that the Russians, and Putin have said this, is that their backs are to the wall. They know they cannot lose this fight because NATO will be at their throats. And the other thing to remember is that for Russians, they think about the great patriotic war, the Second World War, when their losses in troops were into the millions. America has no concept of these scale of losses. So if people think Russia is going to back down because they've lost, pick a figure, 50,000 troops in Ukraine, to the Russian mind, this is nothing. But I suggest that if NATO gets involved and the casualties get up to 10,000 and the body bags start, we're going to see NATO wriggling and squirming in order to pull out. That's my prediction.
And just before Colin comes back in, I fear that the tens of thousands of casualties of the American and Canadian reinforcements is going to be out here in the North Sea, or in countries like the Netherlands, where I'm speaking from, the troop ships and the troop trains coming from the port of Rotterdam and the port of Antwerp. I live right between the two. The US Army has a big presence at both of them. And there's a Dutch-led project called Military Mobility, which is about rolling the men and material to the Eastern Front across the Northern European plain. With these precision weapons Brian's talking about and the manufacturing equivalent of being outgunned, so being outproduced, even if you get a repeat of 1943-44 with Uncle Sam and the Canadians sending large numbers of men, they're not going to get very far into Europe before the Russians dispatch them, is the horrible truth of the matter. You know, and the Netherlands here, together with Norway, that's two NATO members in Western Europe I'm aware of that conscript 18-year-old girls, at least in the Netherlands on paper. Every 18-year-old girl gets a letter saying, you are now a potential conscript. We don't need you right now. Right, we're only two countries away from the war now, with talk now of Poland mobilizing hundreds of thousands of men. We'll only be one country away. Germany will be a state neighbouring the war if the Poles mobilise.
Yeah.
All right. So an awful lot has been said. I'm only going to pick up on one particular thing that I think might be the crux of it. Well, certainly a question that needs to be asked. I'm guessing that there is mostly agreement between the three of you about this war. That you're not in dreadful disagreement about it. So, but there seems to be a contradiction. You're saying that they want remilitarization of Europe because, well, it's not necessarily a contradiction. I just want clarification here. They want remilitarization of Europe because the current situation is that basically Europe is, and the West is flabby, complacent, hasn't known war for, on any large scale for three generations, and is now lazy and so on. And we don't have the production capacity to support a real proper large-scale war. So are you saying that the idea here is to basically force the European countries, European populations, into a war mindset so that they can, so that they'll then approve of their whole societies transforming into that, into a war footing? Massive production of ammunition and weaponry, and then sacrifice of lives on the battlefield. Is that accurate?
I think that's what...
That was kind of my comment, and I think largely yes, but let me try and expand a little bit on it. It's not necessarily because the West is flabby or, you know, soft or anything like that, but it's all about power. And this is what the 2018 article that I was talking about a model towards a model of the new war, of the deep state was trying to unpick. And it was this: if you're going to have power on a global scale, you need to have three things: Europe, America, and Russia. If you can control Europe, America, and Russia on a global scale, who exactly is going to argue? It's about power. Now, if you then look at the position that was there, well, Europe and America were pretty compliant. Flabby, yes, but compliant. And you had Russia, which was not playing the game. So therefore, one of the aspects of this is regime change in Russia, and that's something that's been explicitly spelled out by American and British military leaders and politicians alike. And another thing is the change in the mindset of the population, because we have a population that is not in any way minded to go to war, so they need to be frightened into it. And then a follow-on from that is the upgrade of the military capability and military industrial base, which had eroded and needs to be reversed. Because if you're going for a worldwide domination, then, you know, that takes a certain amount of throw weight to make happen. So, yes, it's about changing the mindset in Europe, principally, America to an extent, to make it much more belligerent and much more useful to an entity seeking power on a global basis. And also to change the leadership in Russia to bring them into a similar global coalition, if you will. And so let's get away from any of this nasty nationalism and individual national self-determination stuff that seems to be creeping back in. To the states in the East.
Can I give one analytical key there as well?
Yes.
Some of the younger listeners might not recall Donald Rumsfeld as US Secretary of State for War, well, defense technically, saying in 2003 in the immediate build-up to the Iraq War, and he did this to taunt Jacques Chirac and more generally the French and Germans, saying there's no international legal basis for a war in Iraq. And so it couldn't happen through NATO channels, hence the coalition of the willing. Rumsfeld said in some forum that year, may have been a NATO gathering, there's not just old Europe, you know, by which he means Western continental Europe, the big powers there being France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Benelux, right? There's also new Europe, which is basically the Slavic zone, plus the Scandinavians, to some extent the Dutch because they're anglicized, and certainly Britain, Canada, America. New Europe, plus the sort of Germanic outreach to North America, as it were, in Britain at the centre of that. New Europe does as it's told and does so keenly. I'm paraphrasing Rumsfeld here. And the war hawks, the neocons, think of that generally in terms of, yes, well, these small nations have got such a visceral hate for Europe, that for Russia, that they think of themselves as the great Russia experts. And to this day, the Estonians, a titchy country, are punching above their weight by saying, we have the best counterintelligence. We understand Ivan's mindset. You know, we know this Untermensch for what he is. So there is that alliance that thinks of it that way. And the spear tip of that is this Svoboda or C-14 youth militia in Kiev, led by Yevhen Karas, who gave, to my mind, he blew the gaff in a kind of disclosure of the century, just before the war began in February in Kiev, when he said in a think tank, the Brits are coordinating a West-East axis, which is America, Britain, some extent Germany, Poland, Ukraine, that's the crux of it. And he didn't mention the north-south bit of it, which is Scandinavia, Ukraine, Israel. But these powers very, very much want what David has been describing. And Karas, at the sharp end of it, being the thicko, said, well, when we're successful, we will... And this kind of revanchism, by the way, is typical of that region. The Poles and Hungarians have thought the same and tried to do the same in the past as well. We Ukrainians, if we manage, will do what the Poles would do if the tables were turned, which is we're going to swallow up Poland, swallow up Eastern Germany, swallow up Western Russia, and become the new superstate. Right? All of what I've said applies to everything in sort of the Euro area except continental core Western Europe. What France, Germany, Italy, Spain think of, because they still have the old bloodlines that think that they rule the world and that they more or less gave license to the Anglo-Saxons to become powerful a few hundred years ago. Their thinking is it is the right of all, you know, our patrimony, perhaps in some vague way led from Rome or from our patrician Roman origins, to rule the world. And all of this fighting can go on around us, but we wish to be the dominant force. So they see themselves as the owners of the resources after the crisis ends. And no, I'm not unrealistic about the Russians. Part of the Russian elite thinks the same, that after a limited war with nuclear strikes supposedly contained only to carrier fleets or ports, is that there'll still be a working economy in the West with a new group of slaves ready to be engrossed into the model. But that's what the Western European mindset is, that after this war, it'll be back to the Eastern Europeans and the Africans knowing their place as our slaves. The resources will be intact and we will have the glory of being the patricians that run the world. Very different thinking from Johnny Eastern European or the Whitehall Mandarin or the Hawk in Washington, who thinks, well, these likely countries in Eastern Europe can just expend themselves one after the other until we've brought Russia to her knees.
All right. So then the situation that the powers that we are going for here is... the multipolar situation. Would that be an accurate way to describe it? Because I don't know if they're referring to a different situation there.
Right.
When they say multipolar world, it sounds more writers, cozy, you know?
One of our writers, Ian Davis, and people shouldn't confuse him with being UK Column staff. He's, like all of us, free to speak his mind. He even more so because he's not on UK Column staff, and he's very welcome to disagree with us. He does so in reasoned and polite ways, and not to as great an extent as people might think. His position is similar to that of Jesse Zurawell on TNT Radio, who's quite closely allied with us in some of the things we do now, which is asking the hard questions like, why, Brian might want to come in on this, why is it that the Russians are not preventing the continuing shelling of the Donbass and the civilian atrocities that are happening in that zone when it seems that they are perfectly able to do so? Is it simply that they have superhuman patience, or is it that there is a layer of government that has control even over Russia that wants this war to keep sapping attention and money until a new financial, economic, military system can be rolled out? That is a possibility. So Ian Davis has written the first half, or published the first half, of an article which is on the homepage, ukcolumn.org at the moment, calls, I think the title is Towards a Multipolar World Order. But if you look for multipolar on the front page, you'll find it. As quickly as I can, I will get part two up and people will see more of the detail. But there's a spectrum of opinion. Vanessa Beely, perhaps, at one end, Ian Davis at the other, Patrick Henningsen, a close colleague of ours, somewhere in between. But we're all very gentlemanly, or in Vanessa's case, ladylike, about the view we take. I think to all of us to some extent, and all the people associated with us in the free commentariat, say, of course, the Russians would do the same if they could. We don't trust the Kremlin's motives here either, but we do understand them. And ultimately, yes, there is a financial layer which has deep control inside Russia as well, and China for that matter, that would like to see a multipolar world. And this was foreseen in the Anglo-Saxon version of elite, you know, world power planning in the early 20th century. It was already foreseen, certainly by Aldous Huxley's day after the war, Second World War, that there would come a time when it was not tenable because the cultural capital and the financial capital would no longer be there in the West, or the manufacturing capital. It would no longer be feasible for London, New York, and their European appendages to be the Pied Piper for the whole world. No, you would need regions doing that and running their own fiefdom. So, you know, that's the model we're heading towards.
And the model for this is it's a multipolar world in one level, where you have regional powers looking after the regions, but ultimately there's a single controlling entity. That single controlling entity is European.
The BIS, basically, and everyone's franchisees below them.
And, of course, the model for this is the Book of Revelation, right? So, you know, this gets into what you think's actually going down and where you think the world is going. But the idea that there can be, it's automatically either a single unitary state or a world, or a series of, a multipolar world with a series of regional powers, that's not necessarily mutually exclusive options. You can have one layered over the other. And that's quite likely to be the model that will be employed.
Okay. Yes, please do, Brian.
I just want to throw one thing in here, because I think we're probably showing the audience that we're having, you know, we don't have answers to some of this. We're thinking through this and we're trying to analyze it ourselves. But there was a particularly good book written some years ago called The EU Collective, Enemy of Its Member States, by a gentleman writing under the name Christopher Story. And it's a phenomenal book. You can't really buy it now unless you want to spend a lot of money, but you can find it as a PDF quite easily, The EU Collective, Enemy of Its Member States. And I've always thought that the title of that book says so much, that when we look at the European Union and how it is set up, how it governs itself, how it deals with the component nation states, the European Union is actually an enemy of the nation states which comprise it. And Christopher Story goes into a great deal of detail, a lot of footnotes about what he's talking about. He talks about the machinery of the European Union, and he also equates a lot of it to a Soviet-style communist model. And this is quite interesting, because most people look at the EU and they think it's some sort of benign, slightly buffoonish political system that doesn't work very well. But Christopher Story identified it as being an embryonic project for a very dangerous dictatorship, which ultimately was going to attack and take over each of the nation states. And of course, regionalization has been a key part of the EU policy. What I find interesting about some of the comments coming from Putin, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Ian Davis about this, but if you look at some of the comments by Putin when he talks about a multipolar world, he's describing it in terms of nation states as opposed to regional areas. And
yes, I think he seems to want it in the sense that Russia will be one of the players equal to, yes, any of the other players in that multipolar world.
Yes, whereas the politics that comes through very clearly, at least from Europe and the European Union, is that they see it's just the regional areas that are important. We want to break the United Kingdom into, what was it, 7 regional areas in Scotland, I think, and other countries are not really going to be France and Germany. They're just going to be the economic regions, and that is how the power's taken. But I find it very interesting that Putin seems to have real, what's the word, loyalty, I suppose, to his nation state. He sees Russia as a state, and in his mind, he wants to deal with other nation states, albeit that they may be working in a multipolar world under some form of controls. I'll call it a loose control system. But the other point is, he clearly now must be able to see that the United Nations is another organization which is an enemy of the countries which make it up. Is the United Nations for peace? Clearly not. So I don't have all the answers, but I'll just throw those extra pieces on the board.
Thank you. So if we were to make a rough prediction as to how this is going to progress. The war heats up, maybe spreads a bit, maybe a few nuclear weapons are used. Europe remilitarizes, America remilitarizes, and then that lays the basis for, well, to coin a phrase, a new world order. Would that be accurate?
It would. Now, Ian Davis is quick to point out, even and has done in part one already of his article, Towards a Multipolar World Order, I think it is, that the Russian and Chinese leaderships have for years before this Ukraine war, and even more so now, have said that legitimacy, lawfulness in the post-Second World War era is by resolution of the UN Security Council. Right? The West has resiled from that and has said there's a rules-based order because we're the big guys. But Russia and China, this is Ian Davis's whole point, why he's sceptical about what Brian has just said about Putin, is that in Putin's pronouncements, digital currency, sustainability, etc., is being pushed by Russia and its regional blocs like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So that Davis says at one point in that article, Putin does not see his own country as sovereign in the new world order if he succeeds. That's the whole nub of where the question is. I think if we get anywhere with it, it's that the idea of sovereignty in the early modern era is a pretty complex one, and nobody quite understands the fullness of that term. There's whole books written about what sovereignty means. And different people see different things that they want to see in sovereignty. You know, we could talk about that a long time.
Yeah.
I think you're identifying the issue there quite plainly. The Eastern European hotheads, who now, as I say, have subsumed the middle classes and the respectable conservatives and the churchgoers as well, to my horror, they all intone what I was hearing the hawks in Washington and Whitehall say 10, 15 years ago, which is, everyone knows, in italics, you know, in that ironic way, everyone knows that the Russians are subhuman and that the Russians are imperialists and they want to rule the world from Moscow, which is a very unnuanced position compared with what we're now discussing.
Yeah, definitely.
There's one thing, if I could throw in here, which you may or may not want to pick up on. There was a very interesting discussion a few years ago, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, led by one Tony Blair, a man you may have heard of, and he was chairing a discussion about religion with a lot of religious leaders, including a Baptist pastor from the United States. And when it finally came time for the American pastor to speak, he was saying, well, look, you guys in the World Economic Forum, you're always talking about public-private partnership. So this is the partnership between everything that's the state and essentially coercive via taxation and power, with everything that is in the economy, essentially voluntary and moneyed and to do with ownership and property. He said, but these are the only two legs of the stool. You're missing the third leg. And the third leg is faith. And if you're going to mobilize people, if you're going to change people, if you're going to make them act, you need to have the third leg. And he illustrated this with a description of some part of Africa, and he said how many resources there were in the health
just,
sector.
Just to help David, it was Rick Warren of The Purpose Driven Life, and he was talking about Rwanda, whose president, Paul Kagame, who's ruled for a quarter of a century now, invited Rock Warren in to say, will you please make Rwanda the first purpose-driven nation? And he trained the whole civil service. And then Rwanda, a French-speaking country, joined the British Commonwealth and is now the most globalised country in Africa on many indices.
Yeah, so he was comparing the amount of state assets in the particular health sector that were available with the number of churches. And it was the churches completely dwarfed the state assets. And he said, if you want to communicate with people, if you want to make them think differently, act differently, behave differently, you have to mobilise the third leg of the stool, which is the leg of faith. So you are seeing, yes, there's a push to destabilise Russia, regime change. You're talking about regional power bases and global control, yes. But the other thing that we should be looking for is an attempt to build in a religious system to make it all work. Now, they're trying just now to build in a religious system which is called Marxism, neo-Marxism, because that's a religion. It's just a really poor one. So everything that's running through in the Scottish Parliament just now, voting for the Gender Recognition Act, all of the attacks on education, all of the attacks on women, all of the attacks on identity, the hypersensitivity about race, the whole cultural Marxist realm is a religion. I'm not convinced it's going to be the one that will work. I think they are toiling to find a credible religion. So the other thing we should be looking for is people trying to generate or succeeding in generating some form of religious revival that will in fact be the glue, just as the Roman Catholic Church was the glue that held the Roman Holy Roman Empire and held Europe together and held such times as Europe's been united, it was the glue that held it all together. We'll be looking for that on a global scale. Is there anything like that invisible at the moment? No, but it might come along, because their ability to convince the people to think in a certain way that we saw through COVID with the fear-mongering, and we've seen through the long march through the institutions with the cultural Marxists, is substantial, but it's not, I think, quite enough to really mobilise dynamic change in the world to bring about what they're after, be it, Green New Deal and all the rest of it. There's lots of schemes, there's lots of plans, but it all looks a bit inadequate because to persuade the people.
Yeah, what I would say about this is I do agree with you that what you might call cultural Marxism, wokery, progressivism does function as a religion, especially when you add in the COVID stuff as well. That seems like a sort of extra component that has galvanized what was already there. The trouble is that it's all based on weakness. It's not a creed that can propel men into a battlefield. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, it's a hierarchy of victimhood, yes.
And it's based on victimhood and fragility, especially with the COVID stuff. It's, you are fragile, you're vulnerable. So it's not something that, in a war context, I don't think it's a religion that would be very useful at all, ironically.
Whereas if there's an Orwellian, in the true sense, clash of the three blocks, Oceania, Eurasia, East Asia, which of these three contains both Jerusalem and Rome and Mecca? It's the Euro Middle East, Africa block, isn't it? The Americas and East Asia have no religious centre of world significance.
All right. One question that's come in, and I think several people have asked this, and it does actually link with something that I think David said, but I'd like to hear from all three of you on this, just briefly. I'm looking for the actual question here it is. This is from Aaron. Do Putin's actions and responses advance Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030? If so, then is it possible that Putin, a World Economic Forum young world leader, is in on the whole thing, playing his part to advance Agenda 21, just like Zelensky? So, Brian
first there.
Yeah.
This is a very good question, and I know that there are a lot of people asking it at the moment. My honest response is I'm not sure, right? I'm thinking about this as well. But I want to say this. We can see the World Economic Forum at work, and we can see Klaus Schwab boasting of the world leaders that he's been able to bring through his training and reframing programs. And yes, it is true that Putin went through at least some of that training. But it's very noticeable that if you go and check on the World Economic Forum website, although you can find Putin's name, there's no other material about him. He's effectively been removed from their media trail. And I think this is because Putin is not towing the line. I think people who come into the World Economic Forum system, if they want to get on, if they want to share the platforms, they've got to toe the line. They've got to follow the agenda that's set. And I think for whatever reason, Putin has rebelled against that agenda. He was there in position. I think he was seen as a promising leader to follow their agenda or drive it forward in Russia. And for whatever reason, he came to doubt what they were doing, and he started to go down his own path. Now, that doesn't mean he's completely clean, and it doesn't mean to say that we should automatically trust him. But I think that there is ample evidence that he is not at least fully on side with Schwab and the World Economic Forum. Yes, Russia is following policies that appear to be aligned with it, and particularly if we go in a financial direction, we can see that he's moving towards digital currencies. He's talking with China about almost, well, duplicate systems to the systems that the West is talking about. But it does appear to me that he's seeing the world in a different way. And the other thing I'm going to say is that if we start to examine the system which is putting in place a world governance system, and I think that's clearly happening around us, it clearly cannot be true that all of the leaders are controlled and doing exactly what they're told. I don't think it works like that. I think they move in a general flow of a river, but they fight, they squabble, they climb over each other for power and privilege and money. And so they are not fully in control. And I think Putin is one of those rebels. If I had to emphasize why I'm confident that they're not fully in control, they're not fully in control because if they were, we would not be having this conversation.
Yeah. I've figuratively and sometimes literally been in the room when heads of government discuss these things, because I've had a privileged existence first as a spook, then as an interpreter. And that means sometimes you're 6 inches from a head of government discussing these matters. So I can say with confidence that Blair treated Putin as beyond his control and beyond the control of his superiors, whether you think of Schwab or other European figures like Bilderberg or whoever you want to see in the picture, committees of 300, whoever you think Blair is a front man for, and he clearly is a front man for many of these, Putin was beyond his reach. And to the chagrin of his own people, his own spookdom, Blair was, in his usual naivety and vanity, thinking that he could charm Putin back on side about the time that relations with British spookdom went sour in the mid-2000s. There was a time during Putin's rise, five years either side of his succession to Yeltsin around the millennium, so about mid-90s to mid-2000s, where British spookdom thought, we'll get you all, between brackets, back, we'll get you on side or back on side. That game was given up. Putin was already beyond control by then, right? Seen from the Western-based globalist think tankery. And as to Brian's other point about the squabbling and scrabbling like rats to get one up on each other, that is very much what heads of state and government are like in West and East. And not very long ago, I was, again, the guy just behind the shoulder of a couple of heads of government from Europe, as they were talking about the latest urbanization plan, which we're seeing in West Africa now as well, to create deliberately urban areas, megacities that span 3, 4, 5, 6 countries. So as to, as Richard Haass of the CFR said it in the 70s, to do an end run around national sovereignty. And in these plans, they don't just say, it's Uncle Klaus or Uncle this or that who's given us the orders, but these highest elected levels do say to each other, face it, guys, the plan is quadruple the population, put in the infrastructure, wait for the immigrants to arrive, sell it to our own people, brutalize them if they complain. But when they look at each other, they don't say, ha, 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 then our master plan will have succeeded. They say to each other, Now let's think of the other heads of government who aren't in the room, who are in our part of Europe. How are we going to do one get one over them financially? How are we going to present our half-baked plans as a fait accompli to them? They're clearly two or three levels below the decision-making capacity.
All right. David.
Yeah, the issue about Putin. Firstly, the idea that everyone's in on it and whatever happens is all part of the master plan, I don't like, because it's extremely defeatist and it's not realistic. Looking at Putin, he's clearly not compliant. And I think it's very easy to go far too far with the, well, it's problem, reaction, solution. You know, this is a technique that is used on us, but it doesn't mean that everything is part of this picture. The comparison point I would give you for Putin is, in fact, JFK. Because JFK was essentially levered into the White House on some very dodgy dealing and questionable votes. It was quite possibly a stolen election. And he was the son of someone who was very hostile towards Britain, very sympathetic towards Germany under the Nazis, and whose political career died as a result of it. But he was not someone that you would be looking to champion the country. He was an insider. He was from the elite. He was groomed for that particular role. When he got into it, and he was also compromised with the womanizing and everything. And when he got into it, what did he do? He looked at what the CIA were planning in Cuba and said, this is insane. I'm not doing this. This will result in the death of millions of innocent people. No. And by the way, I'm going to scatter the remnants of the CIA to the four winds. It won't exist when I'm finished with them. Now, they shot him. If they could shoot Putin, I'm sure they would. But he was a man groomed to be a compliant member of the club. And he saw what they were doing and he rebelled. And there is always the likelihood that people would do this. And essentially, I think that's what Putin's done. I don't know how far along the route of being compliant he ever got, but he certainly got into position and he saw what it was being done to his nation and he rebelled. And I think we should recognise that.
Yeah, I think a problem that some people, a mistake that some people fall into, and it's a way of thinking, really, is one piece of evidence is enough. One data point is enough to make the point. That proves the thing, and therefore the thing is always true and will always be true. So, and I see this with what I might call, this is going to sound bad, but low IQ conspiracy theorists. They'll find one piece of evidence,
yeah,
and then that's it. And then the trouble with doing that is the thing in their mind, the thing is always true. So then they have to somehow integrate it with stuff, yeah, that ends up being contradictory. So their worldview, their model ends up being very muddled. But they have to do it because everything is true. That is true, that is true, and that is true, and that is true. It's always true. So therefore, you've got to find some way that these things work together. And it ends up being really bad, really insane stuff, and just clumsy and incoherent. A more nuanced view, a more sophisticated way is to think, okay, that thing was true. That data point is real. That thing was true there and then. But that's it. It doesn't necessarily mean that the thing is always true. So you've got to rely on other data points. So the thing I'm referring to here is obviously Putin was a World Economic Forum, I think, young leader or whatever it was.
Yeah. Or the predecessor, because it was called something different before 95, but when he was a rising politician.
So, I mean, there it is, right? So he was young. That's another phase of his life. You can arrive at a more coherent model if you accept that that thing was true then, but isn't necessarily true now. So it's just a point that I wanted to make.
Can I just add a little bit or come in again?
Yes.
Totally agree with what you've just said. I was thinking another indicator that Putin is special, let's just describe him as special, a rebel, is he is now pointing at things that are happening in Western society, which are incredible. One topic, and with when we've been with you before, I know that we've covered the subject of child abuse, but Putin is pointing a finger at Western governments and saying, these are governments running on the abuse of children. These are governments carrying out a satanic agenda. These are governments, the Western governments, are attacking their own people. They are destroying or trying to destroy the concept of a man and a woman. They are denigrating society by enforcing a normalization agenda with gays and homosexuals. And he is also talking about the church. Now, the reason I find this so interesting is because these topics are so hot in the West that we can now see, and I know Alex wanted to talk a bit about censorship, we can now see, let's give the classic example that's happened in UK in the last few days, a woman arrested, strip searched, and she's going to be in court in the new year because she stood and prayed on her own outside an abortion centre. So we are entering the phase in UK where the thought police are not only in action, if they get hold of you, they're going to strip search you, humiliate you, and you are going to appear in court. And Putin is pointing his finger at these things and saying, this is not only horrific and wrong, you Western societies need to wake up to what's unfolding around you. And I've got to say that he's absolutely right. Now, I've just put a little hook in here, if I may, for the audience. I've mentioned the book, The EU Collective Enemy of Its Member States. If you find that, just search for the title and PDF online. In the first 10 pages, I think it's probably about page 7, there is a grid, a matrix,
a table,
thank you, Alex, in which a policy is described to break down each separate area of Western societies to make people fat, destroy their health, destroy their jobs, to destroy religion, to inflate sexual behavior so that it takes everything out, to undermine the military. It describes all those things until society breaks down to such an extent is there's normalization. Now, normalization is the application of actually a Soviet communist phrase, which is really talking about revolution. But why this is so interesting is in Christopher Story's book is that he naturally assumed that this plan to use psychology, amongst other things, to break down Western society was an inherent Soviet communist plan. And yet here we have Putin, who many people think, well, OK, he appears to now be have left communism behind, but I'm sure he's really a communist. But Putin is warning the West, Western society, of these very attack points which we see in against a Soviet background. I'm going to say, Alex, help me out here if I'm not describing this pretty well, but no, it's astonishing that Putin is able to say that Western governments are ruled by paedophilia, which in my opinion is completely true. That is how the blackmail system works, the abuse of children. Mm-hmm. He's warning about the breakdown of the sexualization of society. He's warning about the breakdown of religion. And he is absolutely saying, you need to see what's unfolding around you. We are not going to let this happen in Russia.
All true, yes. Absolutely. But without circling back to COVID unduly, he has allowed the 100 or more federal entities, constituent entities of Russia, one by one in their public health policy, to weaken the minds and bodies of their population through the jabbing with the Sputnik V jab. Nevertheless, it's true, all that Ryan has set out, he has warned of this. Sometimes he's the subtitles go way over the top to as a kind of sensational bait for Western audiences. But most of what Putin says is accurately translated, particularly if you watch or go to the Kremlin transcripts in English right. And the Russian Foreign Ministry statements. And there has been no parallel in Russian society. The Western, particularly the Eastern European detractors, like to say, ha, Russia has its own demographic time bomb and it's the dying of drunkenness and whatever. But there's been none of this weakening of mind, body and spirit on every axis in Russia in that last 20, 30 year time frame that there has been in the West, that going through the whole of that page of Christopher Story's table, every domain of life, the collapse has been there and has clearly been fueled in the West, but nothing right. like it in Russia.
And that's the key, because we see in Britain, we see in Scotland, we see down to local authority level, the agenda that's been set internationally, the global agenda, the global governance agenda, the stuff that's World Bank, UN, UNESCO, all these organisations that set the policy being employed, being rolled out. And we see Putin not complying with a great deal of it.
Just before we went on air.
And pushing back hard against a great deal of it. And that's the bit that tells you he's not on board. It's his actions define his beliefs.
Just before we went on air, the women won't huished. We're in the public gallery at Holyrood again. You might have seen David, or might not yet. And because the vote has now gone through for gender self-recognition in Scotland, the women won't huished. Or what their noisy spokeswoman lifted her skirt. Mercifully, she was wearing underwear, but she did so while saying, "If you won't respect the women of Scotland, I'll disrespect you." That's the level of breakdown that we've got to. Nothing like that is conceivable in Russia, of course.
Well, the words "republic" and "banana" do come to mind, but I sympathise with her point.
All right. Let me just go through the questions to see if there are any more about Russia. I'm not sure that there are. Here's one from Hinchfoot. If the law was changed tomorrow to block migrants crossing the English Channel, how would our armed services deal with 20 rubber dinghies per day packed full of gentlemen who are unwilling to cooperate? Brian, would you like to take that one?
That's a naval question.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it incredible what we're watching, which is the fact that we used to have border controls and now we've either become so incompetent we don't have border controls, or those border controls have been deliberately pushed to one side in order to enable people to come across the channel in rubber dinghies. And I'm going to say, many years ago, many, many years ago, when I was giving all sorts of public talks and I could be invited to a political group or a non-political group. So I want to say I spoke to many different groups of people. But on one occasion, I did give a talk to a BNP audience. And in the talk, I put up a picture of Birmingham Central Mosque, where I had also given a talk at one point. And I said I would discuss the subject of immigration, and then deliberately I didn't. And what was the result? At the end of my talk, somebody stood up and used some pretty forceful language and said, "Brian, you didn't talk about the migrants." And I said, "No, I didn't. Would you like to talk about that?" And they said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, can I ask a question? How did they get ashore? Did they fight their way ashore?" And the audience went very quiet and said, "Well, no." And I said, "So we invited them in." And a man stood up at the back and used the F word and said, "I didn't effing invite them in." And I said, "Okay, that's fair enough. Who invited them in?" And eventually the audience had to admit that the people who had invited them in were the politicians. And then I said, "Who's your enemy, the people who were invited or the politicians who betrayed you and let them in?" And after that, we had a very good debate. Now, I believe that the key to migration and immigration was revealed very concisely by the former UN ambassador for migration, Peter Sutherland, who is on record as saying, quote, "We need more mass migration in order to break down the homogeneity of the nation states." So the migration is a policy of the European Union. It's a policy of the globalists in order to destroy the nation states. And I've said to many people, you may be unhappy at what's happening, but just remember that when the camps are established, it's not going to matter whether the person next to you is black or white or Asian or Muslim or Christian, because we're all going to be in the camps. So what we've got to do is understand who is driving the policy. Peter Sutherland is now dead, but it's clear that the promotion of migration is a high-level policy by at least the UN, and I would suggest certainly the World Economic Forum, and it has a simple agenda to destroy the nation states. So are we going to see the Navy stopping these rubber dinghies coming in? Of course not, because the enemy, the real enemy, is within this country. David, I'm going to look to, because when we started to discuss what was happening in this country, we came to the conclusion that we were being attacked by our own government. And David described it as a government of occupation. And I think this is where we really get this debate to go somewhere where we need to go. And that is that people have to understand that in Western countries, it's happening in the States, but also in here in UK, our government is not working for a national policy agenda to provide us with a happy, healthy, prosperous life into the future. Our government is implementing Mr. Schwab's agenda, and it is going to use every means it can to break down society. So no, the Navy is not going to stop those rubber boats, because the policy is more migration, more mass migration, to break down the structure of this country. And I think once you grasp this reality of a government of occupation, we need to stay friends with these migrants, because ultimately the strength is in people standing together against the government of occupation. David, I'm not allowed to do that.
let me add a few things. Right. Firstly, right, actually, government of occupation is Brian's phrase, not mine. What I actually said was it's an occupying power. It's not a government, it's an occupying power. And the reason I came up with this is I was seeing people who were being attacked by the government, and they were getting in deeper and deeper because they kept appealing to higher and higher levels of government for help. And the more they appealed, the more they struggled, the tighter the noose formed round their neck. And their struggles were actually counterproductive. And it was because they had a completely false image of what the state and what the government was. So I said, well, you know, imagine it's an occupying power. Would you behave like this? No. No, you would be much more cautious. You would think carefully about your every interaction. You wouldn't be sharing information randomly with parts of it because you would be far more wary. So this was an attempt to get people to realise what they were dealing with. And it was born from seeing the pain that was actually inflicted on people when they were behaving as though the government was benign and basically good and had everyone's best interests at heart, but somehow there'd just been an unfortunate sequence of 48 misunderstandings and errors and the wrong people and, you know, rotten apples and otherwise good barrels. And somewhere, if they keep struggling and keep appealing, someone will say, oh, look, we're very sorry and we'll sort it out. And that was never going to happen. So that's where that came from. Now, why will the Navy not stop the boats? The Navy won't stop the boats because the Navy no longer knows what it's for. Remember, it goes back to this hybrid warfare. We're in this hybrid warfare against the Russians for reasons unknown. Everything's part of the struggle, and we are basically one with the Europeans. So it's not really, the channel's not that much of a border, really, honestly. Now, it used to be very clear. What was the purpose of the Navy? First and foremost, the Navy was to defend the channel and to control, to dominate the channel in the North Sea. Right? That was point number one, because that's where the trouble would come from. Point number two, we had to make sure that the Scheldt estuary and the bits of Holland that have particularly easy access to Britain were not in the control of a hegemonic European power. That's why there is an independent Dutch state, and that's why Belgium exists, right? Because we made it exist because it was in Britain's interest that that part of the continent was not controlled by a hegemonic power based in either France or Germany. And then the Navy would protect trade links and overseas interests. This was all rational. It was all based on British interests. It's really striking if you read the formation for the Committee for Imperial Defence. It was formed in the late 1900s. It looked completely rationally at the threats that was the nation faced, and it came up with a rational, competent approach to how to defend against those threats. And that doesn't exist, right? Immigration, politically driven, destabilizing levels of immigration is one of the threats that the country is currently facing. And there's not even a discussion about that, let alone the involvement of the military, let alone developing a military that's actually capable of tackling that threat. We've now given over the Scheldt estuary and certain parts of Holland to the domination of a European superstate, and we seem to be not thinking that there's any problem with that. Rather than seeking friends where we can, we're blowing up pipelines in the Baltic. None of this is rational, and therefore the military cannot possibly succeed against the background of a political system which is leading it towards failure. It's not possible under those circumstances that it could ever stop the Boers.
Right. Ireland has already had senior politicians telling them, prepare for the population to double. Maybe 4 years ago, David spotted a letter to the press from a Church of Scotland minister somewhere in the West Highlands saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could import 1 million extra people to, I think, where it was Argyll, wasn't it? So when you get no pushback against that, then, blaming the Navy isn't going to cut it, is it? And once again, it's not that many weeks ago since I was at this chateau at an undisclosed place in Europe with these heads of government saying, face it, guys, we're full up, but the immigrants are not going to stop coming. Like, they don't particularly want the immigrants to come, those heads of government and heads of state, but they know they're coming.
It's something that's beyond them. As long as they have this idea of national government just being a servant to global powers, fixing this problem is going to be beyond them. We don't have that long left. We've got about 25 minutes left, so I want to rattle through the questions. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I thank you for it, but I want to rattle through the questions and then get to each of the topics that that each of you wanted to talk about. So, okay. Gorgeous Redhead says, what does the panel think of the notion that the channel migrants are in reality the UN force for the next lockdown? Do you want to talk about that?
I haven't yet seen a structure that would make that likely. And sorry, but whether it's Albanians or Syrians or Kurds, that they are muscly, crew-cut men who have the nice sunglasses and stand with an erect posture doesn't cut it for me, because a large swathe of the world in what you might call the greater Middle East produces such vigorous young men, and these are the men who've left their vulnerable kin behind and literally and metaphorically pushed to the head of the queue to get themselves there. Not a few of them are gangsters, so it's like the Putin talking point earlier. If you think these are the UN troops, you have got something which would be a necessary proof of their military status, but by no means a sufficient proof. People used to understand this basis of logic. Or another way of putting it is consistent with a theory that they are troops in waiting. But many other things are consistent. Sorry, that is, it is also consistent with many other equally valid hypotheses, such as that they are the most determined and, in some cases, the nastiest men from their home countries and not part of any military structure.
That's a very interesting breakdown there. Thank you for that. Okay, the one other thing that I would say to this is they already had enough people to police the first, the COVID lockdowns. So they don't need I dare say that it would be it could be advantageous to them to have a foreign policing force who don't have any connection to the natives mm-hmm. whom they're policing. That might well be grimly advantageous. But as I say, it's who knows? It's difficult to say, and I don't think it's sufficient evidence. Brian,
yeah, I agree with this. I don't see any evidence at the moment that we've got secretive troops coming in amongst these people. But I do see that we are bringing in very, very large numbers of people for whom we know nothing about their backgrounds. And whilst they may go through some vetting procedure as to whether they're going to stay here as a migrant or as a refugee, I do not see the depth of vetting that we can be sure who these people are. And I know from talking to many serving police officers that they're very happy to tell you that it is just recognised now that national gangs are controlling our cities, and those gangs vary. They might be Bangladeshi, they may be Eastern European, they might be Romanian. So one of the dangers of the uncontrolled migration for me is that we are seeing undesirable people being able to install their gangland criminal activities in UK in a way which we should not possibly tolerate. And the other thing I'm going to say is that where these people then come into employment, they are useful to the occupying powers, because if they don't have a good grasp of English, they certainly won't have a good grasp of how the country works, they can be manipulated very easily in order to do the bidding of the occupying power, to the disadvantage of the indigenous people, whether you're white or whether you're third generation Asian, Indian, Pakistani, whatever it is. So I see that there is a deliberate, they're just failing to vet these people properly. And I think that is deliberate. And I think it's being done because if your overall objective is breakdown in this country, which I think we see unfolding around us, then if you can increase criminal activity, that helps things.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't want to dwell too long on that question, even though it is a very important one, but there are other things to get to. Okay, this should be a fairly easy one to answer. And I think David already answered this by the by. Who does UK Column see as responsible for the Nord Stream 2 fiasco?
The same alliance that I just mentioned. Britain, Poland, Ukrainian regime elements, some of the other hardcore allies there. It will have had a nod and some technical support from the US, I think. But it's likely that the core planning, and the Germans have hinted that they know this is the case, and the Russians have denied responsibility, which makes some people giggle, I know, but they have. So it looks like, with the Swedes perhaps also, who are very capable in their own turf, looking on, it was probably a British-Polish special operation at core.
Well, remember the Polish MEP who has very close links with America and the Pentagon.
Radek Sikorski.
Yeah. He tweeted out famously, "Thank you, USA." Subsequently deleted the tweet, but he did tweet that out. So Yeah, I think we know which direction we're looking in for that. It's either an American or a British American or a British American and other interested parties operation.
Yeah, I think no question the US and the British involved. So this would have been with naval forces, but also US Navy SEALs and British SBS. And they would have trained, in my opinion, they would have trained the operatives to the nth degree till it was only, okay, you guys get in the water. We've trained you. Get in the water, blow the pipeline up.
Right. Everything else. I suspect that the frogmen themselves would have been Poles in that scenario.
Yeah. Well, everything else organised principally by the US and the UK, without question.
Don't forget the doomsday thinking of Slavdom, non-Russian Slavdom in general, is we're going to have to get the Anglo-Saxons and in some cases the Germans to suffer for us. They must give us all their munitions and they must, you know, cut off their own hands to spite their faces if only it results in Russia being contained. They don't care about those countries, they care about themselves, obviously.
A final note on this subject, it was one of the most laughable and funniest parts of the year, watching the BBC trying to convince everyone that the Russians did it, right? When the Russians had a button and could stop the gas and turn it back on whenever they wanted, the idea that they would blow a hole in the pipeline and blow a hole in the pipeline located just off the coast of Poland and Denmark and Sweden is, that was probably the comedy highlight of the year.
Yeah, it was it was absurd. But yeah, okay, we'll move forward. This is from Enlightened Despot. He says, UK column has replaced the mainstream media as my favourite and most reliable news source. Well, I'm glad you're no longer going to the mainstream media for that. The way I used to think of CBC or the BBC, keep growing, keep fighting. That's a nice comment. So, okay. Kitfu, ask Alex and the guys if they have studied Brendan O'Connell's work. He propagates the multipolar world order in terms of the Anglosphere and the rise of Eurasia, Israel, Germany, Russia, China. Brendan O'Connell.
Okay, very briefly then, with no particular malice towards him, typical case of an analytical genius who has her chip on his shoulder, not a man with the stability to stay the course. I understand he has a fire in his belly and he's been chased around many countries. I know some of his backstory. His key talking point is sound, which is Talpiot, spotting the geniuses and forcing them to serve Israeli deep state interests. That's not a conspiracy theory. Unit 8200 and Talpiot and all these programs are well known. Unprecedentedly, since I left GCHQ, British spookdom and the political level above them have said, we want to copy that, we want to do what the Israelis do, to the extent that we're now burying GCHQ operatives in primary schools to spot this talent and say, you will work for the conglomerate or else. That's now happening, yes. But O'Connell then goes on to say, it's all fake. The Iranian regime is all secretly Zionist. The Russian regime is controlled by Chabad Lubavitcher. I have little time for that argument, I'm afraid. These are massively complex Byzantine ancient empires of Eurasia. There's always 7 to 15 factions duking it out in the palace, and a new generation and a pro-Western guard coming up and an anti-Western guard coming up. So the idea that there is a solitary or a unitary Tehran regime or Pyongyang regime to capture is a bit risible to me.
All right. I'll move forward. Enlightened Despot also says, sorry if I missed it, but I would love to know Brian's military and journalistic background. Well, Brian did go into that early on at the start, but I don't want to bring that into this stream in detail because it would take too much time when I'm sure you can find out about it elsewhere. I'm sorry, but it would just take too much time to go into that. I mean, I'm. It's not that it's not interesting to me, it's just it is elsewhere. Okay, he also says, would you agree that the death of history in public schools, meaning state schools, has left the population defenceless to Sean Penn and Bono's and Zelensky's analysis of the geopolitical situation?
Well, obviously, the three of us have got bulging history bookcases. you know, much to the chagrin of our wives. But, you know, you've got to have that basis, really. History is the pinnacle subject. It presumes a knowledge of human nature, economics, geography, religion, culture, the whole caboodle. You can't really do it properly until you're rather mature. And it's not being done at all now.
The false religion that we talked about earlier of cultural Marxism has history at its core, but it's a very fake and false history. And it requires ignorance in order to survive. Right? When everyone's wringing their hands over, the British Empire needs to apologise for its role in the slave trade. And those of us who read something about it say, what, does that include ending it? Does that include probably one of the three or four actually more or less spotlessly good pages in the entire history of the human race, where they campaign against the transatlantic slave trade? Should we be apologising for that? Are you mad? This is where information becomes key. And when you've got a better basis for understanding where we came from, you can understand where we are and where we're going to with much greater clarity. And you're quite right, not be fooled, not be taken in. It's vital.
The worst form of deception, though, remains self-deception. And you can have some peerlessly well-informed historians who are taken in by self-deception, such as the notion of the perfectibility of mankind. You know, that remains the greatest pitfall.
Yes. Okay, we'll move forwards. These are incredible points, and every one of them should be gone into in depth, but we just don't have time. Okay. The father says, "We'd love to know what UK Column thinks of the gender-bending agenda. My daughter at 5 told me she was a boy. The mother supports it while claiming to be Christian. How do I deal with this?"
This is an excellent segue to Brian's talking point of the evening he wished to make on, we didn't call it destruction now, we're calling it disruption, aren't we?
Yes, that's
a major part of that is gender. And Brian had a huge heart for children and for the weight of confusion and worse that's put on them for a long time. So over to you, I would say, Brian.
You're muted, hold on.
I lost my cursor there a moment. This is a massive subject, but essentially the gender bending is the ultimate attack on people's psychology, because you are destroying somebody's identity, knowing that you are a man or a woman, or for a child, of course, that you're a little boy or a little girl and you will grow into a woman or a man. And so this is vicious, the use of vicious psychology in order to destroy the identity of children, the formation of children's identity and personality. And I've said it many times on the UK column that if you look at people in the gay community, they need to be very aware that the future is not going to be people who are gay, able to leave comfortable, safe, satisfactory lives, because the ultimate agenda is that even the definition of gay and people being gay is going to be wiped out. And the ultimate agenda is that anything will go, whatever you want to call yourself, will be allowed. And of course, when you get to that level of there is no rules, you are actually into the satanic agenda. Do as thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law.
So whereas in the 90s, there was a cheesy pop song that said, "I'm too sexy for my shirt," by the 2010s, the refrain has been, "I'm too sexy to be a man or a woman." And very shortly, as Brian has long foreseen, it's going to be, and the elite are already in this category of arrogance and hubris, "I'm too sexy to be a human body." Right? Yeah. I want to be something else altogether.
The agenda is transhumanism. That is where they're going. And so if you think you're going to be in a safe world as a heterosexual or a gay, no, because they are going to destroy humanity in its present form. And that takes the debate into the whole transhumanism, AI, connecting people to computers. And this is where these, I'm going to say, these mad people want to take us. So it's a
very good study on that is the Cambridge historian Carl Truman, C-A-R-L, Truman, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, which is essential reading for anyone who wants to know what's happening with the sexual confusion and the roots of it. And he's actually a mainstream Protestant preacher and academic theologian in the States now, although he comes from Britain. So a very interesting chap.
Okay. The only thing I would add briefly to that, to the person who's wondering what to do, for all the people who are suing the Tavistock Institute for the mutilation of their bodies and are now trying to detransition and restore again some vestige of what they were, and listen to them and perhaps share that with his wife, as well as these comments on the actual satanic and anti-human nature of what we're dealing with here. The stories of the abuse of the people who have gone through the medical system, who have been medicalized, have been drugged, and who have been mutilated in just in order to prove that a man can be a woman, and have come out the other side and said, well, that I was completely taken in here. All I actually needed was someone to listen to me and talk to me, because growing up is hard.
Thanks to Project Veritas, there is now candid camera footage of some of these Dr. Scalpels cackling and saying they'll keep coming back to us for the rest of their lives because they'll be so unhappy with the results.
Yeah. Can we also just put a little plug out for the wonderful ladies in Wales that have been warning about the relationship and sex education agenda coming through in Wales? Ultimately, it will be UK-wide. But they took the Welsh government to court over what they regarded as the blatant sexual grooming of very young children in schools. I had an email a little while ago which said that, not surprisingly, the judge had found in favour of the Welsh government, and therefore these mothers have got to appeal. But your viewer might like to go to
Public Child Protection Wales. And look for a forthcoming article by me on ukcolumn.org that summarises what was brought out in court. Essentially, the government's lawyers in Wales said, children are ours completely. There's a small derogation called the Human Rights Act, which gives parents some rights. But prior to 1998, the state owned children in school, body, mind and soul. That's the serious argument that's being made in the countries that are pushing this the hardest now.
Prior to 1998, or do you mean after 1998?
Yeah. Prior to 1998, parents had no say over school, is the Welsh government's lawyer's position. And now there's a slight say-so called human rights, but it's very circumscribed.
Right, okay. I mean, this is like Cambodia year zero kind of thing, where the party that raises all the children.
I discovered very recently in a French book that as the Khmer Rouge were marching their latest waves of victims off to be massacred, they were ordered to shout, all is well, enforced jollity.
Incredible. All right. So, Brian, is there anything else that you want to say about the concept of disruption? We've got about 10 minutes. I've spoken to the next guest. He's happy to wait. It's fine. So would you like to cover that topic in more varied way?
Very quickly.
It's an interesting concept.
Very quickly. I believe on one of the earlier talks with your good self, I will have mentioned Common Purpose, a charity which I started to investigate probably about 15 years ago now. We saw a charity burying its way into organizations in order to bring future leaders within its control, and we saw that inevitably when Common Purpose got inside an organization, be it education, the military, the fire service, the police, the government, things tended to break down. And at that early stage, I was warning that here was this quasi-secret charity. It had its own common purpose and agenda, but wherever it installed itself, you would then see breakdown. Now, at that time, we also started to see people speaking about disruption. They might label themselves actually as a change agent, but in talks, they would describe the need to disrupt organizations in order to help achieve the transformation, the future transformation that was planned. And what we are now seeing is as though somebody has taken the lid off this. And I've just looked to my left because on another screen I can show some of our previous UK column news that we did, where Debbie, former nurse that is very good researcher, put up headlines where the word disruption appears. So I've got Sky News, snow, ice and freezing fog cause rush hour disruption. The I, the ministers call COBRA meetings to minimise strikes disruption. Forbes, five things you need to know about the disruption economy. The World Economic Forum, resetting the future of work, agenda, disruption and renewal in a post-COVID world. I could do many more, but maybe that World Economic Forum will excite people. Resetting the future of work, agenda, disruption and renewal in a post-COVID world. We are watching chaos unfold around us. This is not our imagination, it's happening. And the chaos is being driven by people who are specifically trained to disrupt and break down established bodies, the police, the court system. We are now in the breakdown phase. Why is breakdown desired? Because when there is chaos and breakdown and people are running around like headless chickens, the new society can be introduced.
Yeah. And the sharp point of that is the digital identity. The leading comment item towards the bottom of our homepage at the moment is a top-notch German philosophical piece entitled The Crisis of Western Political Systems, which David also helped to edit for me, which concludes with the reason why the chaos and disruption is needed.
If I can segue into economic matters for this, because Brian mentioned the phrase reset that's often used. Now, Colin, you'll know that in Scots law, the reset means the possession and selling on of stolen goods. So when Klaus Schwab says it's going to be a great reset, people in Scotland who know a wee bit about these things think to themselves, oh yes, yes it is, because that's all about theft. Now, they've been trying to run the world economy based on thieving and counterfeiting, and it's reaching a really interesting point. So one of my areas of watching very closely into the new year is in matters economic, and we've traced this back to about 2019, just before COVID. There was an economic crisis that didn't get reported very much in the repo market, reverse repo market in America, where the banks were running out of money and there was a decision to print a great deal of it. And this was, something happened then, something seemed to break. And ever since then, the amount of money supply in circulation seems to be dictated by the central banks in a way that's never been the case before. So something seemed to break. And central bank policy was one of printing vast amounts of money, expanding the money supply to a level never seen before. And that is, of course, inflation. And with inflation comes price increases. And we have this very strange situation where Powell, the head of the Fed, back in 2020, making a speech, and he said, we're not even thinking about raising interest rates. Excellent. So a short time has passed, and all the worries about inflation, it was contained, it was temporary, it was transitory, all of this proved to be nonsense. And we're now seeing the central banks raising interest rates. And some very strange things are happening. The central bank balance sheets are going into the red. The Bank of England, because it's all based on bonds, government bonds. All the banks, including the central banks, are stuffed with government bonds like never before, because that's what they were buying to, quantitative ease, put money into the system. As the interest rates go up, the bond prices go down. And the Bank of England are in a hole, which we will have to bail out as taxpayers, apparently, of 188 billion and counting. It's getting worse daily. The Fed are losing vast amounts of money and are filling it with little bits of paper which are completely unbacked. Basically, promises to put something valuable in there later when we finally have it. So all the central banks are in serious trouble. Their balance sheets are awful. So they now have a situation where they have to either bring inflation down by putting up interest rates, which is bankrupting the central banks, or they have to stop, pivot, and go back to printing money. And when that happens, the value of the paper currencies, particularly the dollar, will go through the floor. So they are in a dreadful, dreadful position, entirely of their own making, because we've been running on funny money since not long after 2000. And the consequences are now becoming really clear. So there's going to be a crisis. There's going to be a very significant monetary crisis. It's quite likely to involve a collapse in confidence in the dollar. That will be a great reset, but not the sort that Klaus Schwab's talking about. And that will see a major realignment worldwide. We don't know when, but it's likely to be soon. So I think economically and in banking and monetary terms, what we've got ahead is a really fascinating year.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a theory that this crisis in the repo market was what prompted the whole COVID fiasco. I don't know if any of you want to comment on that, Alex.
I suppose, extremely briefly, the case is very well argued by Catherine Austin Fitz and a number of others who've been working with her, that trigger did precipitate the measures, but it's been equally well argued by researchers of the medical scene and how bent it had got at the pharmaceutical research end for 20 years prior to COVID, that there had been a build-up that required this stage in the digitization of society and the capture of the media and politics before the next bug could be turned into the big bogeyman that COVID was turned into. So that was the long-term background, and I think the proximate cause was the repo market, most definitely.
All right. I guess the next thing to talk about, well, David wanted to talk about economics, banking, money and the dollar, but we've kind of covered that, unless there's anything else you'd like to say about that, David?
No, I was just diving into that. I suppose the only other thing is that the tendency will be for people to revert to things of actual value. So gold and silver and real assets. And I would encourage people to read on economic matters, because it will be very useful. The more you know, the less frightening it will be. And you'll be able to sit there and rather enjoy the show and understand things like the crack-up boom when you start seeing it happening, where there is a flight out of paper and into real assets. And that's quite likely ahead of us as well. That's not just an economic matter. That's a matter of psychology as much as it is of economics. But when it happens very quickly. So, yeah, these are areas where I think I would encourage people to inquire and to seek information that gives them insight. And there are some good commentators out there. Most of them are of the Austrian school. And if it's possible to get information that puts matters, economic matters, in straightforward, simple terms about how people relate one to another, how they make decisions, how human beings act, and on that basis, don't believe the hype, don't be just taken along with the instructions you'll get from the mainstream media, which will be wrong, They will lie when things get really threatening, really nasty. They have to lie. They won't tell you when the collapse is coming, so you have to be prepared beforehand, and encourage people to do that.
Okay, somebody has just commented in the live chat, millennials or Zoomers' hopes of getting any real amounts of actual assets are laughable. I mean, this is a problem. It's a generational thing, you could say, circumstantial, that we tend to talk about the boomers, some people, including myself sometimes. There is a sense that for the younger people, it's we're simply never going to have the financial stability or security that our parents and grandparents acquired fairly easily. It's an unfortunate situation.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interject there, but of course, Klaus Schwab has said you'll own nothing and be happy. I believe.
If so, Brian doesn't mind so me saying, I mean, he was a particularly notable boomer in that sense because he was out at sea when Mrs. Gerrish spotted a house and sent him a cable. Have found house, and you had to just reply, "Bye." Will you when back? Didn't you?
Yeah, which is absolutely true. I am of an age where I recognise this, that I'm here in my house, but I, for my own family, my own children, life is different. What can I suggest? I think the best thing I can suggest is for younger people. They've got to come back to simple core values that when it gets really tough, it's friendships between people, it's charity, it's compassion. Those are the things that are going to hold people together, where neighbours and friends and communities really do help each other. And people need to recognise this when it gets difficult. It hasn't got difficult yet. But when it gets difficult, people have got to come back to being people and showing love and compassion for their fellow men and women. And that is one of the key ways that people are going to survive. If the government of occupation achieves its objective of breaking people up and breaking up families and relationships and groups of people, and we're all isolated, we will not survive. So I'm conscious we're coming up.
The core point that was underpinning that question is quite right as well, because there's two things that have happened. One, women have been forced into the workplace, and this is essentially more or less doubled the amount of labour and hence reduced the value of labour. And it's now no longer possible to do what was quite normal, even when I grew up. I mean, I'm not quite a boomer. I just missed that one. But growing up in the 60s, everyone was finished work and was home in time for the magic roundabout, 5:45. And they would watch the news together and eat together. And the wives were almost all at home. Very few wives had to go out to work. That's been now forced on them economically. And then the other thing was when the last vestiges of the gold standard were taken away in 1971, then the situation which had been in the case, which was the poorest in the Western nations were advancing more rapidly than the richest. The gaps were closing and everyone was getting wealthier. That stopped. And after the link to gold was lost, the rich became very rich, very, very rapidly. And the advance of the poor rather stagnated, and the gap grew exceedingly great. Add to that the problems of taxation and the states taking ever more, and you have a situation where it's not imaginary; it is real. It's not that the current generation is living beyond its means, or is not being sensible, or is not being careful with money, or anything like that. It's that it is under much, much greater financial stress than was the case a generation or two ago.
All right. Obviously, a huge topic. We could go on about it for ages, and it would be interesting. But we are all conscious of the time. So, Alex, would you like to bring in the matter of censorship and where you see that progressing?
Well, out of courtesy to your next guest, I'll just keep it to 1 minute, I think, which is that we've seen the buggers off before, and we trust we can do it again, though we're not invincible. We've been doing TV news for a decade now at UK Column. Many people think that's the only thing we've ever done. But Brian was slogging away for years with Mike as a newspaper before that. Nothing prevents us in theory from returning to that if the exigencies of the situation require it. We haven't even really got into audio to the extent that we might want to if there's a social media or video-based censorship agenda advancing through Parliament yet again. But last time we saw the buggers off by publicising what we were being threatened with and being told, they literally told us our production was too good. You are too television-like. You need a licence for that. And we publicised that, and our friends from all corners of the globe called the body at Ofcom, called ATVOD, the Association for TV On Demand, that was purporting to do this, to bring in this scheme. And it wasn't the UK Column that ceased existing as a result of that. It was ATVOD that ceased existing, you know. So we know who our friends are. And Brian was saying a moment ago, have a network around you. We haven't ever known the West in our lifetimes what it is for there to be a hunger for food, but also not what it is to have a hunger for information. In the likes of Poland, they do know. And if we are reduced to word of mouth or very simple hand-billed distribution and standing on barrels to deliver the message, you ain't seen nothing yet. You know, we don't actively welcome or wish for that, but we're perfectly able to thrive in that situation too, for as long as we're given life and liberty to speak.
Excellent. That seems like a good defiant note to end on. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and it's very interesting. So I've really enjoyed it. Is there anything else that you'd like to say just as a closing statement, Brian, since you are the founder of UK
Column? I'd like to say, well, we're coming up to Christmas, and we'll say for everybody a holiday period, and you would hope people are going to be with their families and friends and enjoy themselves. Being happy is very important, because the whole agenda of this occupying power is to depress people and make them unhappy. If you do all the things you can to remain happy and you show that you're happy, you frighten the pants off the other side, because they're thinking we're doing all this to depress and suppress these people and they're still happy. So, you know, if you want to make your life better in both ways, the happier you are, the more unhappy Klaus Schwab is.
Well, indeed, success is the best form of revenge.
Yes.
All right. Okay, on that upbeat note, I'll be back shortly with Toadstool Magazine. In the meantime, UK Column, Alex Thompson, Brian Gerrish and David Scott, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Merry Christmas.
All right, okay. Thank you. See you soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.